Okay, so as I guess everyone knows, this is a discussion on the origin of life. We have a number of people here who have actually written quite a bit on the subject. And Freeman Dyson, who's actually written the book Origins of Life, as well as in his other books, has offered to give us a few-minute introduction of just some of the major areas of field, and then we could just open it up to a general discussion.
Good. Well, I wasn't prepared for the speech at all. I remember saying, I don't know whether it was in my book, which the book was, by the way, published about 20 years ago, and most of it's sort of out of date. And one of the things I either said or wrote, I forget, was that the real clue to origin of life would be the archaeology of the ribosome, that the ribosome being the most ancient organized structure that we probably have still remaining from the early days. And so that should have a tremendous lot of clues as to what went on at the beginning. And then now, after that, finally now we got there. I mean, the excavation of the ribosome is now finally beginning, and I think that's very exciting. So we don't yet have the information, but we shall have it within a few years. Understand from, especially comparing different ribosomes from all kinds of different species and getting clues as to how the thing could have been put together. And that seems to be probably of fundamental importance. And in a way, to until that's been done, almost everything we say has a high probability of being wrong. However, we still continue talking. The other thing, of course, which is going ahead very rapidly, is the archaeology of the primitive Earth, which is probably a lot easier, but still, it's going ahead very nicely, and we're starting to know a great deal about what Earth was like around 4 billion years ago, which is probably roughly when all this started. I was just reading a paper by Ewan Nisbet, came out in Nature some time ago. I don't know whether you've read that. It's a sort of speculative paper about habitat of early life, which I found illuminating.
Where did you put it?
Well, he's thinking, I mean, he's not really placing bets about where life began, but rather looking at the primitive Earth as a place where there were very rapid variations in climate of an even more drastic kind than we've had recently. When the Earth got hit by large impactors, which happened, of course, as we see from the face of the Moon, the period around 4 billion years ago was a very heavy bombardment. And the Earth was being hit repeatedly by objects big enough so as to boil the entire ocean, and so that any life that existed at that time would have been heavily selected toward things that could survive boiling. And that would, even if the original life wasn't hypothermophile, it would explain why the survivors were hypothermophiles. And I think that makes a lot of sense. And then during the cool intervals, they could find local niches around volcanic vents and so forth where they could survive. And then when the ocean boiled, they would be in good shape.
Just like home.
So I think this but it makes sense of a good deal of what's been observed recently. And of course, what goes with that, of course, is the considerable probability that it really all started on Mars. So you know that you may have noticed a paper by Joe Kirschring recently. Kirschring is a rock magnetism expert who lives at Caltech. Probably many of you have seen that. He had studied the Mars rock, which was alleged to have living remnants in it. And of course, what he's done has nothing to do with that, but it happens to be the same piece of rock. So he took a slice of this piece of rock and measured carefully the magnetic field patterns, which are quite strong. So the rock is magnetized in a complicated way. And then he put it into an incubator and slowly raised the temperature and observed that several of the magnetic features disappeared before it arrived at 40 degrees Celsius. So that means to say that during the whole time of its passage from Mars to the Earth, the interior of that piece of rock never actually got warmer than 40 degrees Celsius. It's quite an interesting fact. So if there had been any living bugs on board, they could easily have survived the trip. And he's not saying that that actually happened in this case, but it could have happened 4 billion years ago when these rocks were being thrown from Mars to the Earth, probably a million times more frequently than they are today. The other thing, of course, which is very sad about this is that piece of rock actually was in the deep freeze in Antarctica for about 14,000 years. And then instead of transporting it back to Houston in a freezer, they let it warm up, which is very sad. So that in fact it's only, that's why it's just temperatures in Houston are not noticeably cool in summer. That's why Kirschring couldn't push his limit below 40 degrees Celsius. And if they'd only kept that piece of rock in the freeze for the few years after it was discovered in Antarctica, he might have put a much lower limit on the temperature. Anyway, so next time they find a Mars rock in Antarctica, we hope they'll treat it more carefully.
But why do you say it's probably originally from, it probably came from Mars, but it could have come from many other places?
You mean life?
Yes.
Well, Mars is the most likely, because it has a much lower escape velocity. It's much easier to kick rocks off Mars and have them land on the Earth than the other way around. And it's extremely difficult to get stuff from the satellites of Jupiter. And if life had originated on Europa, it's very difficult to get stuff from Europa down to the Earth.
But you're not making any statement about the ease of originally landing in Mars compared to... I mean, there's one thing about transportation, but...
there's also the fact that Mars probably cooled off more rapidly. So, Mars might have had a much gentler climate in the early times. But that's purely pure speculation, of course. It certainly wasn't, when Mars was originally put together, it would not have been as hot as the primitive Earth.
But are there any estimates to say, with a given bombardment on Mars, that we can send off secondary rocks into space, what fraction could possibly arrive on Earth?
I mean,
is
yes.
That a tiny number in itself, or is it?
It's a small fraction, but the aggregate number is very large. It works out that, I mean, the calculations have been done, it works out at a few per century or something like that. It's a reasonable number. And I mean, it's remarkable how many, we've already found 12. And we haven't searched bottoms of the ocean. There may be many balls sitting on the bottom of the ocean. And the fact that we've already found 12 with only a few years of searching means that there must be a lot more.
And people are sure they are from Mars.
Yes. That is unambiguous because you find exactly the right in one of these rocks. I mean, it's not the same one that was alleged to carry traces of life, but in one of the other Mars rocks, you have a good sample of gas inside the rock. And the sample agrees precisely with the Mars atmosphere. And the others are like that. I mean, so geologically they are similar. And so since one definitely came from Mars, you can be pretty sure the others, they're quite different from ordinary meteorites.
Where did they come? Did they came
14,000 years ago, this particular one.
Oh, they're very recent, okay.
Oh, yes.
This one.
They don't last that long. The ones that are more preserved are the ones that happen to land in Antarctica.
What kind of life would either survive going through space or survive the boiling of the oceans?
Well, going through space naked is probably not very good for the health. But if you're in a little crack inside a rock, you could survive quite well as long as the rock remains cool. And so that's what's being talked about here, that these chunks of rock, which do come from Mars, which could have any kind of primitive life forms hidden inside, they would have a good chance of surviving. Because surviving the boiling of the oceans, it simply means you have to be able to survive 100 degrees Celsius, essentially.
It could also involve complete drying of the oceans.
That's evaporated. Yes, that's even worse. So in that case, you probably are dead no matter where you come from.
But could life, very, very early life, exemplified by what you describe in your book, could they have survived? Could those very, very ancient, very primitive forms, just on the verge of being alive, could they have survived better the hardship of bombardment and evaporation?
I have absolutely no idea. What you're talking about is sort of a very, very, very unrealistic model, which I put into my book, of how life might have become. But that doesn't pretend to be a description of how things really were. And so I have no idea what the most primitive creatures were. Very likely rugged in the sense that they were much less fine-tuned modern creatures. One might expect that they would have had an easier time surviving, but that's just your guesswork.
Raymond?
Yes.
The number of us here who are not familiar with your model, can you describe it maybe in a few minutes in the essence?
Yeah, I've forgotten most of the details. That's probably just as well. This was simply a way of describing the transition from non-living to living, the first transition in the language of paramagnetism. It's a simple-minded physicist's description of this phase transition. So the idea is that you have a population of what I call monomers, which simple molecules which could diffuse. I was imagining a little vesicle, something like a little globules of water surrounded by an oil membrane or something of that kind. But nowadays the fashionable stuff is iron sulfide, which could do just as well as a membrane, and there are various metal sulfides considered plausible and painful. You have water surrounded by a membrane, and these little molecules can diffuse in. When they combine to make polymers, then they get stuck inside, and so they build up a population of bigger polymers. So that is essentially, so the model is essentially, it's a population of polymers which are all the time exchanging with the monomers in solution. So you have the polymers are mutating just by losing and gaining monomer components. So that's a sort of, that's a picture of a population of polymers which can be chemically active. They can act as catalysts, catalyzing each other's synthesis or hydrolysis. And what the model is essentially, it's a mean field model in terms of ferromagnetism, that you hypothesize that there are two kinds of monomer sites, those that are correct and those that are incorrect. And so it's a secular definition, but those that are correct are those that are able to catalyze correct placement of other monomers. So there's a bootstrap operation that they catalyze the synthesis of other molecules, which would catalyze synthesis of others and so on. So it's a could become a chain reaction, catalyzing organized structure. And the incorrect monomers don't do anything. They're just, they're dead and inert. And so what the model describes is that you can have a random collection of polymers which are quite disorganized and don't do any catalyzing. And then by the statistical fluctuation, you can make a jump to an organized state where the fraction of correct sites is larger than 50%. So then it becomes essentially a metabolic system, a system of molecules which is keeping each other going by mutual catalysis. So that's the model. It's a very simple model and doesn't attempt to do any real chemistry. But the interesting thing is that it works, mathematically speaking, with a population of monomers. If you just count up the number of monomer sites, it works at a level of about 20,000 monomer sites, with reasonable probability for making this phase transition. So that was the main sort of the main quantitative.
20,000 different?
Was that what?
20,000 different monomers?
No, 20,000 total sites. The number of species should be about 8 to make this work well. And the
number of species of monomers?
Yes.
But the polymers would be in many, many more forms.
Oh, the polymers would have huge variety, yes. And you don't, they're not supposed to be at all specific. There's no self-replication here at all. It's just they have a tendency to catalyze each other's synthesis, but they're not exactly catalyzing their own reproduction. So the population then maintains itself, but without replication.
How do these things break up? I mean, there's some mechanism for, otherwise everything gets bigger and bigger.
Yeah, well, the idea is that the population is just in a steady state with hydrolyzing and accreting. But then you can, I mean, that's the model is simply, it has nothing to do yet with Darwinian selection. It's purely just random drift and nothing else. And so these little globules don't evolve, they just exist. But then you can bring in then the evolution by allowing them to grow and divide. So you can imagine that they actually absorb stuff from outside and grow bigger, so that by osmosis, the osmotic pressure, the globules grow bigger, and then they occasionally they'll split in two, and then they'll compete with each other for nutrients. And so then you can get evolution going by a normal Darwinian process.
So what kind of information is being passed along these lines you just described?
Well, the interesting thing is...
In progeny, what?
The information just consists of the statistics of the monomer population. And you can actually calculate quite accurately the amount of information that is carried. And it turns out to be, roughly speaking, one bit of information per site, which is rather remarkable. So this is actually about as efficient as an information carrier as DNA, although it has no exact
sequence,
genetics at all. But there is actually a lot of information there. It's not coded in terms of individual units. It's entirely buried in statistics. So you can actually carry lots of information this way. And it has the advantage of being extremely error tolerant. You can have something like 30% errors and the thing will still work.
Would it be fair to say, as we have been saying in some of our papers, that the information here is compositional?
Yes.
How much of each kind?
Yes.
There is.
Not only how much, but where. I mean,
also location.
Yes. I should mention that Doran has carried this a great deal further. So he has made much more realistic models based on the same general idea, but paying much more attention to the chemical details. And so he's actually done a great deal more with it than I ever did.
It's a good opportunity for me to say that the first time I ever thought I would do anything having to do with the origin of life was when I read your book, Infinite in All Dimensions. And there was a small chapter there, and I was looking at what you wrote there, which basically amounted to the idea that you can carry information and transfer information and undergo self-replication without polymers of the kind that we have today in the form of polynucleic acids. And I said to myself, this cannot be. Just like everybody else says today, it still has to grab the imagination of people that indeed you don't need polymers to transfer information. And it was your teachings that started it all.
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, of course, I didn't invent all this. It mostly came out of conversations with Leslie Orgel. You ever talk to Orgel? He's not so far away.
I spoke to him many times. He's very adamantly pro-sequence, pro-nucleic acids.
Yes.
So how come you extracted this idea?
An example of thesis and antithesis.
So you try to go as far as possible against Orgel? But seriously, was he at one point a proponent of such ideas?
No, but we argued a great deal about these things. I mean, he's a broad-minded fellow too, and so we were trying to devise models for origin of life of all kinds. This was just one of them.
But I'm missing something else. So you use composition as a sort of coding of information, carrying information, but then things we need to have sort of different kind of information, so you need to have lots of stable, if I think of composition, the different composition as a sort of attractor of the dynamics, then that would just be one, and you need to have a whole line of these attractors so that can have a different sort of information to
No, in this model, there's only two attractors. I mean, either you're alive or you're dead.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so and then there's a saddle point in between, mm-hmm. which is not an attractor, but it's just an unstable saddle point.
But then once I get this thing, if it's just one or the other, then what's the information? It's urgent.
Well, you can calculate the information. It's essentially just the logarithm of the minus the logarithm of the probability of that particular population. So you can actually calculate that quite precisely.
But can you comment maybe a bit on this sort of the way this information is encoded? So I have, say, these eight species.
Yes.
Just the percentage composition, that would be just eight bits.
No.
But it's much more.
Yeah, it's the actual population of polymers with their occupations. And you have to, I mean, the point is that since it is a purely random process, you can actually calculate the probabilities quite accurately. it's just like a gas of molecules, essentially, and the same kind of statistics apply.
So you're asking how many, what fraction of polymers has this and that composition of?
Yes, how many of the sites are active in the more positions?
Do you write like Smoot-Kosky equations?
No, I never did.
In your writings, you mention very often the word metabolism,
yes,
which so far this afternoon has not been uttered. What in what you describe is metabolism, and how that we heard a lot about metabolic networks,
yes,
and gene networks. Can you make a connection?
Yeah, well, what I was talking about, when I talk about metabolism in this context, it simply means the recycling of the monomer units among these polymers. That's all it is. It's just a process of recycling that keeps the system active, so that each of these polymers acts as a catalyst, catalyzing the placement of the monomers in the others. So it is just a mutual sort of collaboration of the molecules in keeping each other active. That's what I mean by metabolism. So it's just the process of chemistry that's going on all the time, which is sort of characteristic of life.
But after all, metabolism is just the same. In present-day metabolism is about proteins keeping other proteins active.
Right. And the difference is that now it's done according to very precise programs,
right,
whereas in the early times it was probably more or less random.
How much of a role does just binding and buffering play a role?
Not at all.
Not at all. I mean, it would in metabolism, yeah.
What do you mean by binding and buffering?
Just molecules that would arise to bind other monomers and keep them at a more constant concentration within the developing matrix.
Well, Freeman sites basically embody a phenomenon like this.
Okay.
So they bind, all right? They bind.
Yes, they bind, and then they can unbind again. So you have all the time a flow, so a constant exchange of monomers from the surface into the fluid. But I didn't go into any sort of detail with that. Yes.
Well, I'd like to come back to Tara's question, which seems to be an important one, about there surely can't be just one composition of polymers that make a blob alive. There might be sort of many different compositions that are self-maintaining. And so I understand Harry's question to be, do you have an idea of how many such different compositions there are that would qualify as a life state, so that we can have a sense of what is the space of possible life blobs that selection could start going on?
Yes, well, I never asked that question. I mean, I simply have one composition which is active and one which is inactive, and that's all there is, and because the model doesn't include any chemistry. Because in the real world, there would be many possibilities for different chemistry, which could lead you to all kinds of different kinds of population. But that would largely, I suppose, that would largely be geographical. I mean, in one place you'd have a different chemistry from another.
Okay, so you're thinking, okay, so for each vesicle, depending on details of the chemistry or whatever, then you have a different composition of the attractor for that vesicle.
No, I think they're all the same, essentially. I mean, the model doesn't pretend to be realistic, right?
What's in the back of the mind?
The vesicle, every vesicle is as good as every other in the model. And they all have, I mean, all the ones that are alive have the same composition. The ones that are dead have a different composition.
Then what's the next step? Okay, so now we've got this composition.
Well, the next step is then when they start to grow and divide and compete with each other.
Then you need to have different composition if one.
Obviously, there will be selective advantage in being able to divide more rapidly or to feed more efficiently. And so you get then biases toward different kinds of chemistry. Yeah,
but that would be a function of the composition.
Yes.
Do you have some specific hypothesis of how the dividing goes on? Because eating, of course, is very important, but multiplying is less important for having life going on.
No, I was imagining just that in the early stages that you'd have these droplets floating around and occasionally being broken up mechanically just by being hit by a raindrop or something. So I didn't have any. I wasn't trying to analyze that carefully.
At some point, probably one would have to imagine a coupling between the fission process and what's inside.
Yes.
In order to get sort of a selection.
Right. I mean, they would undoubtedly that would happen very rapidly. That the droplet, which happens to be able to divide spontaneously, would have a huge advantage over the others. So you expect that to happen.
Wouldn't that sort of happen naturally, somewhat just by growth? I mean, it's a larger and larger droplet is more likely in the end divided.
Right, anyway. But the time would obviously come when they would begin doing it, making the process of division an active process.
If you watch these droplets under the microscope, under natural conditions, which means temperature gradients and some convection and some physical obstruction here and there and flows and so on, nothing is at equilibrium, and it's very likely that droplets will fuse and undergo fission all the time. Actually, it would be far-fetched to think that they will just sit there and do nothing under real conditions if they are in the ocean.
What are possible candidates for the monomers in this type of model?
So I'm not a chemist, and of course lots of chemists have thought about this. And you know more about this than I do.
I think what is important about your teaching, if I may say so in front of you, is that you say that it doesn't matter what the chemistry is. And there are, in this realm, there are two schools of thought. One that says, wait until the monomers, as we know them in our own present life, arise, and only then can life begin. Wait until there is alanine and tryptophan, or maybe just a few, as Ed Trifonov is saying, so many amino acids, but or some other people say, wait until there are nucleotides in all their glory with ribose and with the nitrogen base and phosphate and everything, so that life can begin. And the other side of the coin, and that is what Freeman Dyson has taught us, is that it's the principle that matters. It's not the exact chemistry. So you can have a small measure of catalysis exerted among any kind of chemicals, some better, some worse. And therefore, the principle is that it doesn't matter what the chemistry is. But there is one thing that is important, and that is that there will be some kind of adherence, that they would come together and form droplets. And this brings one's thoughts back to Oparin with his primitive cross-survey droplets. Everybody sort of sneers on that and says, oh, that's very primitive, RNA is beautiful, RNA is much more elegant, and so on. But basically what you want is cross-surveys of any chemistry and with the right kind of network within them.
Yeah, that's quite correct. I mean, I should have mentioned Oparin, of course. He was the real originator of these ideas. And it was unfortunate that he happened to take the wrong side when it came in, Lysenko came along. So just because he was a bad guy doesn't mean his ideas were necessarily wrong.
Because he was a bad guy, he survived that period.
But Ed,
thank you so much.
You were a good guy and you survived.
No, no, I survived because of different reason. I was on the other side, on the other side. Yeah. It happened actually that after he survived, he was all right. And he even managed to present a couple of my papers to Russian Dokladi.
Mm-hmm.
But that were not papers on Origin of Life. And I don't know, by inertia of hatred to the secularism or by other reasons, I thought that apparent things are all bullshit. I wouldn't think it this way now, but still, I don't believe much in merely conservative life formation. It could be, for example, one could imagine the high concentrations. Volkovsky mentioned in the right moment the diffusion. There are only two ways to avoid the diffusion. Is to sit at the generator, and the generator itself will be alive, and then let everything diffuse, or make the core surveys. And I think that, say, volcanic vents, they're perfect generators.
Of what?
Of whatever.
No.
You just said that life is not necessarily nucleic acid.
But what volcanoes or sub-oceanic vents generate are very simple organic molecules. The crux of the matter is that simple organic molecules, under some conditions, will form more complex ones, very idiosyncratic ones, and in combination with others in a particular locale.
So let me do it near the vents.
Well, but in the near vents, all you get is food. You don't get life out of them. So you have to go to the core sulfate idea. You can call it by a different name. You sit by the source of monomers, but the idiosyncratic polymers with high X, that is high activity, will form one in a billion times in a particular place, and you need to keep that together or you don't have life.
There is a much simpler argument. Life today is cellular life, so these are co-acervates.
Okay, well, that's one good argument. I was going to make a comment on the question. There was a nagging question here that wasn't really answered. Where do you get diversity from? Because without diversity, there is no Darwinism and there is no real life, as we know. And I think that the essence is in your assumption 8, which can be modified. Assumption 8 reads, it says also that it is a drastic approximation, and it replaces the average of efficiencies of a population of catalysts by the efficiency of an average catalyst. Now this is beautiful as a toy model, and it tells us about a particular mode of behavior of a system. But all you need to do is to have a large enough computer and teach it to play games with a lot of different values of catalytic efficiencies in many different monomer combinations in the form of polymers, and then you get diversity very cheaply. So it's just taking this model and extending it and relaxing assumption 8.
Right. I mean, that assumption is just a mean field approximation, which clearly is not true. It's just a simple way of deciding to do it with pencil and paper instead of on a computer. Nowadays, one does it on a computer much better.
How about these two questions coupled into the diffusing away? And as long as you work consistently in the mean field, think you have a certain efficiency of the average of this population. As soon as at some point something away from this average starts to grow, then one needs to worry how this information diffuses away or can maintain the whole volume in the end. So it seems to me that these two issues are in fact related.
Are you saying that fluctuation can destroy mean field?
I'm just saying, if we start to consider fluctuations about the mean field, then immediately move over to a spatial picture and we need to say how they move in space, if they diffuse away, if they die out or grow or...
Like,
has there been any attempts at experimental vinification?
Yeah, but there's a fellow in Glasgow, what's his name? Russell, I think, does experiments on a lot of these metal sulfide membranes.
Well, never mind who, but has there been any progress? Because what you described, as far as I understood it, just calls for some simple experiment which would provide at least some answers to these questions. And if not, then why?
Well, I haven't really been following it at all, but I know my original idea was one should do experiments with a million little droplets. With mixtures of molecules picked up off the floor and watch and see if they do anything interesting.
Which is pretty straightforward idea. So my question is, did anyone try? And if not, then why? Because I've heard everything. I didn't get an answer to this straight question.
Mark, you're looking at me. I will try to provide some answer, but you want to say something?
No, is anybody in the last one doing experiments like this?
The one word answer is no. but I think
it's a scaffold answer, because then why? And why? It is so straightforward that must be something that we are missing.
But what is perhaps debatable in your question is the word straightforward.
Yes.
You just said 2 minutes ago.
Let's ponder what he said.
So we have already the God and his prophet. Go ahead. Who is who? Oh, you want to be gone? Okay, and Freeman, you're a prophet.
I wasn't sure what you meant.
I think the technology for doing this sort of experiment didn't exist until very recently. I mean, it really needs the sort of the modern technology of microarrays.
Right.
And being able to do a million samples.
But now it's there.
Well, only recently.
No, but only recently and not necessarily in the right direction. This technology of arrays that Freeman is talking about moved in a particular direction about which we heard in the first couple of months here, and it is very earmarked to look at nucleic acids and their binding. I would describe a simple experiment, quote unquote, straightforward as you call it, Mark, that pertains to the system that we are talking about. Freeman said millions, but maybe you have to say billions or trillions or quadrillions. You have to look, and actually in your book there is an estimate of how many droplets you have to go through before you may have a chance of seeing something. Now the point is that we are used to bulk chemistry. Anything we do, we take a beaker or we take a test tube, and if we are micro, we take a nanoliter, which is still a huge volume. And we look at the average properties. We try to look at the chemistry that goes on. But what you want to do here is to look at assemblies of molecules that only have, say, a few tens of thousands of molecules, which is very, very tiny. And there can be many of them in a volume, but you have to find a way to watch each of them individually. Because at the rate, in the very early stages of an emergence of life kind of an experiment that one ponders here, everything would be very ineffective. So you cannot hope to see anything like PCR starting from one molecule and filling in a test tube with the same exact copies or almost exact copies of DNA. What will happen is everything will be very, very sluggish. So the only way out is to watch each individual assembly and do a tally of how many kinds of molecules there are inside and how they change with time. And basically, we don't yet have the technology to do that. Not to say that we wouldn't in our lifetime, but right now there is no technology to do that. Although it's beginning to emerge. It can be built upon the array technology.
Okay.
I would suggest one way. I already suggested it to Dorwan. His particular model is based on the vesicles made of hydrocarbon membranes. And this vesicle would feel best if they would synthesize hydrocarbons. In which case, one unexpected suggestion comes. What about very, very efficient hydrocarbon generating machine which generated all the oil fields today? And if you think in this direction, you may well find that mechanism which makes your first concentrational life. Just demonstrate that your corcerates, or whatever you call them, vesicles, generate hydrocarbons. And we get lots of funding. We are an energy deprived country.
I would add to that you actually described a specific experiment. As to billions, trillions, and whatever, since you don't know, only the experiment can answer. As to the problem you're talking about, it is already well in the progress, or I would say is well known, just in the field, which is pretty far off from what you are accustomed to, which is mesoscopic physics. So what I may say that since there is a lot of interest and it is of importance, why not just try to look in a different direction rather than argue that it is impossible?
Why do you call it a different direction?
If you believe this is your direction, even better. I don't care about the world. What I say is...
Well, what you're talking about is mesoscopy. There is no question about that.
So what I'm saying is that the methods which are developed there are readily applicable, and maybe you will find if you describe the experiment as specific, and if the problem is the one you mentioned, then I believe that this problem is basically solved. So maybe it makes sense to try.
When you say the exact nature of chemistry doesn't matter, what is it then that defines chemistry, and what are the sort of minimal critical components of what we would call chemistry that are necessary for the system to work?
Well, it's roughly speaking a catalyst that's with a specificity of the order of 100 that's needed. In this model, you can calculate that the discrimination factor that you need in order to make it work is actually e to the fourth, and it happens to be precise number, fourth power of e, which is about 55. And so you have to, your elementary catalyst has to have a discrimination factor of something like 100 to make it work. I mean, we know today that biological catalysts have discrimination factors around 10,000. But the factor of 100 is not difficult to do with a single metal ion, for example. A lot of metal ion catalysts are about a factor of 100. So it means that the fine tuning of the catalyst doesn't have to be all that good.
Does the stability of the bonds matter?
Yes. That will determine the rate at which anything happens. So it must be reasonably stable, but not too stable.
Yeah, I'm wondering about the general relationship, things like Mandelbrot forces and hydrogen bonds as opposed to covalent bonds, those sorts of things.
Yes, well, I've never got into the details, but I would expect that hydrogen bonds would probably be about what you need, but I don't know.
Is the problem with diffusion of the various participants in the autocatalytic set is so severe, and maybe indeed it's easier, and I'm speaking in terms of the probabilistic chances of having life emerging, maybe it's easier to assume that there is just one polymer which is autocatalytic, and then you don't have to hold it with any membranes, because he's always himself there, and all he has to do is to have the right environment of monomers which and to replicate itself. And then maybe the in terms of probabilistic quantization would be much better off.
No, well, that's the other, that's the sort of the opposite pole from what I'm talking about. I mean, maybe you can make it work, I don't know. But I prefer to think that life started with garbage rather than with something highly organized. And
you mean you believe that there is no autocatalytic substance which is not highly organized?
Well, what do you have in mind?
I don't know. If I would know, I would probably tell Duran to do that experiment.
Then you tell Manfred Eigen to do that experiment.
But you see, that experiment, that's true, it's basically Eigen, yes. But at least there, it's only one experiment, he wouldn't be able to tell me, it's not billions, but trillions, and then it doesn't work quadratically.
But it's the same, no. The truth of the matter is that a single autocatalyst, in the honest sense of the word, is just a special case of a mutually catalytic network.
Which doesn't have to be held together, this is what I'm saying.
Well, okay, the question is what is cheaper, to hold things together or to get a single autocatalyst, which can only beget more single autocatalysts, which is very remote from what we call life, and is also not very easy to come across. Holding things together is extremely cheap. Why should we argue about this? It happens all the time. I mean, anything that has a little bit of hydrophobicity will hold together. Anything that is charged will hold together. This is the rule rather than the exception.
Yes, but you also have to bring inside that membrane.
No, it doesn't. That's not probably a misconception. To begin with, it doesn't have to be the ordinary, nice, well-structured membrane that we know today, with a nice two-leaflet bilayer, with an internal aqueous medium. It doesn't have to be like that. It can be a lump, as Freeman calls it, a garbage bag. Actually, I would call it a garbage ball, because it's just a lump of matter that holds together by relatively non-specific forces, and molecules within it begin to play games with each other. The lumping is easy, the playing games is difficult, but the playing games, asking for playing games is the same for an autocatalyst as it is for a lump. But a lump has a better chance, you can show that, because you have many different kinds of molecules. To be autocatalytic, look at how many years have been invested in trying to make an RNA that will catalyze its own formation, to no avail. And making a lump that will have a rudimentary capacity to help more molecules come in or get formed within it, of the kind that already exist within it, may be much easier. I think what is really important for people like ourselves is to ask this question in a specific manner, to try to do simulations that way and this way, and try to place probabilities, real numbers, on the capacity to do either that scenario or the other.
No, Donald, I was exactly convinced of this until you answered to Mark that it would take quadrillions. Now, if you give us to quadrillions, then I have to go back and think twice. Maybe it's better.
Still, he generated that, I believe. Maybe I'm wrong, correct me. I'm a little bit confused. In your mentioned theory, what is the estimate? Is it 10 to the 6, 10 to the 20? And what is the estimate on the number of populations? Because if it is 10 to the 20, then forget about experiments, I don't understand what we're talking about. If it is 10 to the 6, then it is within reach. The same question is about the number of populations. So whatever are the assumptions, do you have these estimates?
Oh, yes, but I mean, the point is you can actually choose the level of in probability just by adjusting the size of the droplet, so that, I mean, it's, you can arrange the experiment according to your taste. You could do an experiment with very small populations where the probability would be 1 in a million. If you make even, you just make the population twice as big, and the probability would be 1 in a trillion. So it's very easy.
So what is your best bet? Suppose you are to suggest an experiment. What is the reasonable best bet within the framework point of your theory? What are the estimates?
Well, I have never done a careful study of this because I don't think it makes sense unless you put in real chemicals. But that
is easy because real chemicals that the experimentalists can supply have known properties, and therefore, for any real life experiment, your theory of this, I put in this paper, would be the estimate. So it becomes an academic question to do experiment. The answer may be very close by.
Mark, you still live in a realm in which you assume that if you take a quadrillion droplets, that's no problem, and a glass of water will hold it.
No.
Let me make the argument and try to show you what the problem might be. You assume that you do that, and something measurable will emerge, that is that suddenly one of these droplets will begin to proliferate at the expense of others and will become dominant in the glass, in the beaker. This might happen, but the question is how long would it take? The question is how slow and ineffective or quick and effective the process is. You live in a world of what people like Morowitz and others call school chemistry. School chemistry is you take a beaker of HCl and a beaker of NaOH and you mix them together and you get salt and you can measure it and it's easy and nice. But the real chemistry that started life was minuscule, was very sluggish, and if you want to repeat that, you may have to do it in a volume of a cubic kilometer and wait 1,000 years, if not 1,000,000 years. Can we do that?
It seems to me you are talking about the field which you little know with all due respect, because Freeman agreed with what I said. Namely, if you plan any real experiment with real incoming things, then theoretical physics can provide you with the answer to the questions they ask. Therefore, instead of starting with arguing it may be anything, there is a way to answer whether this approach is indeed possible.
Have people tried to obtain estimates of time scales of formation of certain classes, say, of course, in terms of diffusion coefficients and diffusion through these membranes. I mean, there will be a number of parameters, but those could be measured. But given those, could one estimate the time scales?
Well, in the model that I was describing, you could calculate all these things quite easily. And in fact, the numbers come out quite feasible. I mean, that if you want to have a fraction of 1 in a million making a phase transition within a year or something, then that'll correspond to a population of 30,000 molecules per droplet. But if you change that only slightly, you can bring it down to 1 in a million per day or 1 in a million per second. And so since the rates vary exponentially with the population size, it's very simple to tune the rate to anything you want. And roughly speaking, if you want a rate that's reasonable at one sort of 1 in a million level, as far as I remember, it corresponded to populations like 20,000. Which is very small. That's the problem. I mean, these are submicroscopic. It's not nanoliters. It's femtoliters or something. Yes.
There's another aspect I didn't appreciate quite well. This has to do with coupling to energy flux. The life design blooming process should have energy, everything going. So in your model, where is this non-equilibrium as manifested? It's a catalytic network. How's the energy?
Well, the energy is supplied by the monomers coming in.
It's monomer carries energy and then they can do whatever.
Positive binding energy,
right,
when they're captured, but which can be quite small.
It should be something that depends on the sort of the degree of the drive you're applying to the system, and
yes. All
of these times and so forth, scale should.
If we're talking about tiny little droplets, diffusion times are very short.
On the other hand, you are segregating things. I mean, you need to pull in lots of, to keep something going, you need to sort of enrich the environment. So you're beating against the osmotic pressure.
I don't think that you need high concentrations of these monomers to have reasonable rates, but I haven't calculated that. So somebody in the back.
Well, it seems important. The question is, why do we need to think in terms of polymers? I mean, the important idea is that of autocatalysis at the level of a set of things rather than a single entity.
Yes.
So all you need is a set of molecules whose interactions lead to the regeneration of the same set of molecules. So that could be chemical reactions among small organic molecules of formula A plus B is equal to C, or C plus D, or something like that, without there being now a specific set of polymers involved. And so that the polymers, so that more goes in the direction of Moravitz's idea of sort of the self-organization in the autocatalytic sense of small core metabolism, as we know it today, in terms of substrates interacting with each other. And then polymers being added later on to the system as more specific catalysts of those reactions.
Absolutely, that's certainly true. I mean, the only reason for talking about polymers is you want something big enough so it doesn't diffuse out.
On the other hand, if you were to think in terms of small organic chemistry, then sort of Harold Moravitz's intriguing idea would start applying that, there aren't that many small organic molecule candidates for forming an autocatalytic set, and that might perhaps then lead to very few solutions, or perhaps the unique solution of such a set, that then would explain sort of the universality of metabolism. Well, not explain it, but would be that there's to the conclusion that there's only one possible metabolism with the chemistry that was possible at that time, and then you have the diversity of proteins later.
Yeah, that may be true, the whole point is that one should do many different kinds of experiments. Some will work and some won't. It's stupid to guess beforehand what's going to work.
The quality of polymers is sort of a figment of our imagination, or more like it's it has to do with what we see. It's not really imagination, sorry, I take it back. It has to do with what we see today in our own life. Okay.
No, just said not our imagination, but God's creation.
I think we accept God enough for tonight. It's not always like that when three Israelis meet together. I'm talking about a breed of Israelis, one that descends from Russia two generations ago and two that came out of Russia in this generation, maybe explosive. back to chemistry. Polymers have to do with a definition of very few monomers that string together in a combinatorial fashion. in organic chemistry, there can be relatively long molecules that are not polymers. You can just string together all sorts of gemish kind of molecules, and they can grow bigger and bigger and become impermeable or become absorbent without necessarily invoking polymers. So the truth lies somewhere between you, Walter, and what Freeman is saying. That is, you can gain some of the properties that polymers bring with them without necessarily assuming the ordinary kinds of polymers that we have in our own life.
Yeah, but also it might be due to our desire to have the Darwinian process kick in immediately. You know, there might have been, because polymers provide you an easy combinatorial diversity, but even if you were to generate such an autocatalytic set with small molecules that doesn't have the diversity, well, you know, it would be a great big achievement because it would still be sort of an alive state, in a way, a self-maintaining state, which would lack the diversity for the Darwinian process to become operative immediately, but then perhaps it would be a sort of first milestone for them to add further chemical items like polymers that then would get the Darwinian process started. So even before there was sort of a Darwinian process, that might have been chemical self-organization with even more, as much smaller, simpler units.
Actually, when we're looking for origin of life, we try to give a definition of life. It is complicated right away. I'm looking for complicated schemes. However, the life perhaps started with a very primitive scheme which wasn't life at all in the beginning. For example, a primitive autocatalytic process producing lots of material, identical material, that's your thought. Or
it's
not more polymeric, or I get or polymer.
No, that's not his thought. It's very important that you see that. He's talking about many kinds of molecules helping each other in a network.
Not necessarily helping
that's
each
what
other.
He said.
Just when you have a high production, heavy production of some molecules, then as a mistake of this production, you may get a system looking like life. It should start with high production and not as a minuscule event.
I was intrigued, if I can interrupt a little bit, I was intrigued by something you mentioned very, very briefly, which was PCR. And I'm wondering, one obvious thing is there is this cyclical temperature fluctuation on our planet. And I'm wondering, could that play a role in the sort of system that Freeman is describing? Either one of you?
Yes, I don't think so, but I've never given it any thought. The
temperature cyclicity of PCR has only to do with the idiosyncrasies of the enzyme used. And so, I mean, not exactly. It has to do with the idea of taking the strands apart and polymerizing on them, so you can go to high temperature and come back to slightly lower temperature.
I'm not saying those exact same set of conditions, but you have that flux. I mean, at a slightly higher temperature, you're going to break more bonds, especially if you're talking about H bonds or whatever. That collapses, I mean, that certainly could play a role in a self-organizing process of any kind.
There is a profound point about cyclicity, that is that if you are always at the same temperature, you can extract energy. Who asked about energy? You can extract energy from light at a constant temperature, which is what light today does mostly, and could have begun like that as well. But if, like some people, you would like to start life with heat-related energy, then you have to have fluctuations, you have to have gradients. And it's not an impossibility that this is what happened. That is that, for example, if you want to split Dyson's globules, you can maybe heat up and then cool down for some more reaction to occur and so on. So fluctuating environment could be very nice.
Follow up on that a bit. So, this have people seriously pursue using energy cycles to as a way of purifying things? I mean, like, you know, some of the bubbles may be kind of not so good, but then so as you raise temperatures, dissolve more, and then you have a chance to make it better and better. Have people thought about that?
Yes, well, I assume chemists are doing that all the time, but I don't know.
In the context of what we're talking about, the
That's not. No, that's not.
The concept of soft aggregation versus hard aggregation, polarization. I would like just to suggest a mental experiment. If you have a set of autocatalytic chemical reactions, you expect it to find its optimum in a few relaxation times, few diffusion times. And if external condition are changed, one of components supply dropped, so temperature is changed, then it will be readjusted and all previous information will be erased. I suspect that our internal intuitive definition of life is should include any energy which is of binding energy, which is high enough to survive this drop. So it should be energy higher than KT in this set. So if you change internal conditions, some kind of this information will be passed to new condition. And then it will be elaborated and become more sophisticated. I can compare this to the development of writing in the human history. Before, it was just the people were just adjusting to the change in condition. But in the moment when writing erased, it was possible to pass the knowledge further to next generations. Okay. So it should be, it's a very primitive model, it should be a mechanism with binding energy higher than several KTs just to transfer the
problem. Then you probably don't want to make it too high because
yes, of course,
complicated
yes.
System, you cannot try to get everything right.
On early stages, with several of them, it increased and with proofreading mechanisms. So.
Mm-hmm. I have a question to you. All the time we are talking about chemistry, about molecules and so on. What about just two interference? Today we have the devices with very low leakage, and I can consider interference. I'm talking about long interference of waves. I can consider an interference as a quote-unquote ion chemical reaction, whatever. Now, you have at your disposal all the enormous advances in electronics. You have an infinite supply of whatever you like. And as far as I can understand, your approach is perfectly applicable to this kind of a situation, which may be much easier to observe. Since you already went away from the what given nuclear assets, why not go in this direction? Is it an absolutely crazy idea, or this may actually be a way to test the theory? Because I can translate everything you said into this language, just to map it.
Yeah, well, but by all means continue. I think it might be very illuminating. No, I never thought about that. I mean, many of you may have been familiar with the Tierra model of Tom Ray, who was looking at the evolution of populations in a much more advanced level when the after Darwinian processes got started. And using an electronic embodiment for his creatures. And that was, I think, very helpful what he's been doing. It's not concerned with the origin of life, but it's strongly concerned with the mechanisms of speciation.
This is correct. This can be readily mapped. And the technique in experimental technique there, is by far more advanced than in any chemistry.
Yes. No, I prefer chemistry because that's what the real stuff is made of. And so
why?
Explosive.
Wait, why? Not on the earth. But why? I don't see any reason for that. If you can give a single argument, that would be interesting. But
no, I don't have any proof of that. But
I would try to give an argument if I knew what you were talking about. Does what interference? Or waves? Waves take across what?
What do you mean across what?
Waves of what?
Waves of what?
Waves of what? It's up to you. You may choose electromagnetic waves.
What are you trying to study?
I am trying to study the following thing. You know that there is the interference of electromagnetic waves, and you know that there is the interference of particle waves. Okay? Now, this process is readily mapped on all chemical reactions. Therefore, what I say...
Can you elaborate on that last sentence?
Oh, that will take you just your semester course. Mechanics, I don't think we have time for that.
Just mention what you mean by that.
Chemistry is waves and particles.
Yes, of course. Also what?
So, at this level, we can proceed very far. But once again, what I said is that the particle wave situation is well known in quantum mechanics.
Right.
It's also very well known that it can be mapped on the electromagnetic waves. Therefore, any word that Feynman and you said may be translated into what is known as the wave interference. Then one can translate what one means by the development of these patterns. This can be observed very accurately because all electronic measurements are by many orders of magnitude more accurate than any chemical measurements. That is what I said, and I understood that Feynman...
I will subscribe to what Feynman said. Life is chemistry, therefore we should speak with it.
We have about 3 minutes before I mean, this is better for our discussion afterward.
You want to ready to work?
Yeah.
I think what was hinted at is that we want to move to something else.
But that's clean.
No, I know.
Didn't you know that you're a moderator?
No, I'm a sub-moderator.
I deputized him.
Richard, why don't you take the reign?
Well, okay, are there other questions that people... Or are there final comments you would like to make?
No, I think I'm delighted that people are getting more interested in this subject, and so I look forward to hearing more from you people.
What are you going to talk about tomorrow at 3?
Oh, that's quite different. That's just preaching. It's nothing to do with science.
But it's science and religion.
No, it's not even that.
Can I ask a further question? You started out talking about the ribosome and the archaeology of the ribosome,
right?
Which is the ribosome itself is quite far removed from what the rest of the discussion is about.
Right.
And I'm wondering, do you see any possibilities for archaeology further back than the ribosome? Is there anything at all that you could suggest looking at
Clearly the ribosome is very ancient, and we don't understand how it's constructed, how it might have evolved. I think it is absolutely essential to understand that. Then if you can find something more ancient still, so much the better.
I think a nice example of such archaeology is in Massimo Di Giulio's paper about tRNA. You take a molecule as we know it today, and you ask how could it arise, and he shows that it may have arisen with two parts that then join to become the present-day tRNA. So it is not impossible that one can look in the ribosome, once you know the exact structure in all its gory details, to try to simplify it and ask how the different parts arose.
Right.
And what is the most essential part, what is the crux of the matter, as opposed to the ornate proteins that were added afterwards.
Yeah. And of course, tRNA may be older, we don't know.
Right.
But there's probably a lot to be learned from tRNA, but I would say almost certainly more to be learned from the ribosome, just because it is so much more complex.
I have a question about previous discussion about meteorite, Mars meteorite.
Right.
Definitely, there lying somewhere in the ice stored for waiting for us. And can you estimate how much of human years effort was needed to extract this particular meteorite or this dozen of meteorites? And can you, well, we can easily maybe predict that in the nearest, if there is substantial interest, then in five nearest years, it will be 50 more, and then we can the question is here.
It's from the order of 10 people this summer hunting for these meteorites. They're going on for about 20 years. It's a small number of person years that's been devoted to this. But I think what more important is how big an area you actually need to search, because they are not randomly distributed. What actually happens is that the ice flows, and the meteorites become buried in the ice. And then as the ice comes to the surface, then and evaporates, the meteorites become concentrated in particular regions. So I don't know myself whether one would actually discover a lot more by searching a bigger area. I don't know. But undoubtedly there will be a large number still buried deep in the ice, which may or may not be worth looking for. I have the choice. Either you excavate them, or else you wait till they come to the surface. It may take 100,000 years. The other alternative, which is of course very attractive, is to look for them in space, because there certainly must be billions of these Mars rocks still orbiting around in space, and it might be well worthwhile collecting them there.
Let's thank Freeman and all the other contributors.